Welcome to Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren. Our website is redicecreations.com. Thank you very much for tuning in. We have an important program ahead of us. We have Scott Tips with us on the line from the National Health Federation. And Scott is has been specializing in food and drug law and also trademark law. And we have invited Scott today to talk about the very important Codex Alimentarius issue that Scott have been studying and in a way kind of spearheading, if I understand that correctly. We can ask more about Scott, ask Scott more about that later on in the program here. I also want to mention, of course, that Scott will be one of the speakers at the AV2 conference, the Alternative View conference in London at the end of May. We've had Adrian Gilbert and Len Horowitz previously on the program, who also will be speaking at that event. You can, of course, read more about the conference at avii.co.uk or thealternativeview.co.uk for much more information about other guests, date, times, location, and much more. We from Red Ice will be there, and we, of course, hope to see you there as well. Also want to mention here before bringing Scott on that he will be launching soon here the UK and then later on the French branch of the National Health Federation. And this is also something that we definitely want to discuss. The website that you can take a look at for the National Health Federation is simply thenhf.com. That's thenhf.com. And we only have 1 hour ahead of us here today, so let's get this program rolling right away. Welcome to Red Ice Radio, Scott. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Henrik, for having me on. It's my honor to be on your program today.
Excellent. Thank you very much for your time, Scott. So why don't we dive into it here straight away? Tell us a little bit about the health, the National Health Federation, and I guess also why you decided to start this up, and in that maybe you can incorporate how you kind of got involved in this or got your eyes to this issue of Codex and other health questions, so to speak.
Sure, I'd be happy to. The National Health Federation is based in the United States, but it's actually a bit of a misnomer. It should really be called the International Health Federation. The reason it's still called the National Health Federation is because it was started in the United States in 1955, making it the world's oldest health freedom organization for consumers. That is, not a trade organization, not for businesses, but for individuals. And we have members in 17 different countries and have had for decades. So we've been international for quite a while, but we've kept the old name and have just expanded using the old name. But I'm the president of the organization. I became the president in January 2007, so it's been about 2 years now. And before that, I was the secretary treasurer of the organization as well as the general counsel, that is the in-house legal counsel for the organization since 1989. I first got involved because some friends knew of my interest in nutrition and health and my legal work defending doctors, and they got me interested in joining the organization back in 1986. Mm-hmm. And then in 1989, I actually became the legal counsel for the National Health Federation. We got involved in Codex actually about 12 years ago, maybe 13 years ago, and we were sending someone to monitor the meetings. They just took notes and we paid their expenses and that sort of thing, and we reported on it a bit in our magazine, Health Freedom News. Mm-hmm. And but when I moved to Europe and was living here, I realized it was so easy for me to go to the Codex meetings, and I don't know if you want me to give an explanation about Codex at this point or a brief overview of it, but it was very easy for me to attend the German committee meetings of the Codex network, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And quite cheap, and I could stay with friends as well. So to fly from Nice Airport up to Berlin was nothing, and to go to the meeting. So I started attending the meetings in June 2000 as a member of the United States delegation. But when they got tired of having noisy old me on there, and kicked me off. Well, they didn't really kick me off. They just didn't let me on. The third year, I went to a lot of effort, and it was a lot of effort, to get the National Health Federation accredited, that is, to have official status with the Codex Alimentarius Commission, to allow us to be seated at the table, to speak out at the meetings, and to present papers and interact in real time with the other delegates at the meeting. We are unique in that respect, in being the only health freedom organization that has the right to attend, officially attend the meetings and speak out at these meetings. I think the Codex people realized later what a mistake they had made, and they haven't let any other organizations in since, and their requirements are quite strict. So they kind of pulled the ladder up after them after we got on board. And that was in, was that 2002, I think it was. So we've been officially accredited since 2002 and have held on to that status. And we go to probably 3 to 5 meetings a year throughout the world. The last one I went to was in South Africa for the Codex Committee on Nutrition and Foods for Special Dietary Uses. That's the committee that deals with dietary supplements, amongst other things, and one that we are quite keenly interested in.
Very good. And so you've been at this for about 7 years, then. That's a long time. And you can define for us, for the listeners who are yet at this point aren't aware of Codex Alimentarius. We've talked about it before on the show, but it might be good, again, to give a brief overview of what it actually is. And maybe you can also elaborate a little bit. I guess that you've been specializing then in the law side of the Codex Alimentarius issue. Is that correct?
Yes. The National Health Federation and I, both individually and as an organization, we deal with a whole range of other issues, though, from vaccinations and fluoridation and GM food crops and the like to Codex. Codex is just one part of it, but it's the one we're probably best known for internationally, because we are the only voice at the Codex meetings we're the only ones that are able to speak out. And I personally have probably, of all the health freedom activists, gone to the most Codex meetings, most Codex meetings of all. So if I can be immodest and say that, but I have been going for, this is going on the 9th year now for me, and then the 7th year, as you said, for the NHF, having its own particular status there. But NHF did send me as a member of the American delegation those years that I did do that, and then NHF sent someone else prior to me, or at least paid that person's expenses. So we've been involved for quite a while now.
And
but you want me to explain about Codex structure a bit?
Absolutely. Please go ahead and tell us a little bit about that. And then I'd like just to ask you a little bit about actually what the meetings are like, just to get a little bit of an idea of what actually goes on there. But we can take that later on. Yeah.
Okay. Well, just real briefly, so I don't bore your listeners, but Codex Alimentarius is a commission, the CAC, so to speak, that was created in 1963 jointly by the Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Health Organization, which in turn are under the auspices of the United Nations, to develop international food standards, guidelines, and recommendations for two purposes. These are their two purposes. One, to protect consumer health, and two, to ensure fair practices in food trade. And I'm perhaps going to surprise some of your listeners by saying I consider that actually a noble concept. The ideas that food should be safe and that barriers to trade should be eliminated are laudable ones. But where we as health freedom activists part company with Codex on many points is in the implementation of these ideas. So how are they implemented? You have this commission that was created in 1963, and because it was birthed by the FAO and the WHO, the FAO has its headquarters in Rome, WHO has its headquarters in Geneva, then it meets in alternating years in both Geneva and Rome. That is, this year, for example, the Codex Alimentarius Commission will meet in Rome. In 2010, it'll meet in Geneva, and then it switches over to Rome again. Mm-hmm. So we've been going to these commission meetings just about every year. I think we've missed one year, but that was about it. And underneath the commission, they don't do all the work directly. They have in turn given birth to, at this stage, it's always varied, the number, but at this stage, about 27 different committees that deal with different issues. There might be Farms and Fisheries Committee. There might be a committee on food labeling. There's a committee on food hygiene. There's a committee on general principles that establishes the rules and regulations by which the Codex committees and the Commission themselves are governed. There's a whole range of committees. The ones that we are most interested in as health freedom activists and fighters are the Codex Committee on Nutrition and Foods for Special Dietary Uses, mm-hmm. and this is hosted by the country of Germany, so its meeting is typically held in Germany unless Germany says otherwise. Also, the Codex Committee on Food Labeling, which is hosted by Canada, they provide this meeting place, and they provide the chairman or chairwoman, and it's typically held in Ottawa, although this year, and that's the next Codex meeting I'll be going to, mm-hmm. this year, at the beginning of May, it will be held in Calgary in Alberta. And it's important because it says what you can say on these labels. Then there's a Codex Committee on Contaminants. There's the Codex Committee on Food Additives, which is hosted by China, and I went to that meeting last year. I did not go, I will not go to the meeting this year, but I did last year. Excuse me. There is France hosts the Codex Committee on General Principles that establishes the rules, and because it's so close, I'm talking to you from Paris right now, I could just hop on the metro and go to those meetings when they're held. Oftentimes we attend those as well. So you have a large number of committees that meet. Once they adopt rules, standards, and regulations that will affect everyone in all the Codex signatory countries, then those rules and regulations get passed up to the Codex Alimentarius Commission, which in turn votes on adopting them. But I'll tell you, it's a pretty much a rubber stamp procedure.
It is.
Once it passes the committee, the committees, the rules and the standards and guidelines are pretty much rubber stamped by the commission itself. And we've seen that happen, and it's really a kind of a disgusting thing to see because it's so automatic.
Yeah.
They don't even give it much thought.
Scott, does the Codex issue go under the guise of international law? Does this bypass individual nations' law? Or how do you think that this will be implemented at the end? I mean, it's going into effect, as far as I know, in at the end of 2009. Isn't that correct?
No, it's not going into effect at the end of 2009. That's a common mistake that people make that unfortunately was created by some health freedom organizations that don't know better mm-hmm. and have confused the European Union's Food Supplements Directive implementation with that of Codex. It's a frequently made mistake, and when I hear that, I can tell you almost certainly where that mistake came from, even the names of the people who made the mistake. And it just shows the power of the dissemination of the Internet that this misinformation has gone out. No, the European Union's Food Supplements Authorities Agency has put out its own Food Supplements Directive, and that, yes, will be implemented. It is being implemented, and it has been implemented, but will go into full and final effect at the end of this year. But that's something entirely different than the Codex process. We anticipated in NHF that the Codex process, remember it, I even use the term process because that's what it is. It's an ongoing thing. There's not just one standard. There are many standards, some of which have already been adopted. But some, the ones dealing with dietary supplements, probably won't fully take effect until at the earliest 2011 and more likely 2013 if some major catastrophic event doesn't occur between now and then. We already see the world economic crisis unfolding, so what else? And that's going to get worse, so there could be something that will interfere with even this date.
Okay.
But basically, you asked another question in there, Henrik, and it was a good one, and that is, how does it get implemented? Because here it's supposed to apply only to international trade. So how would it apply internally to the United States, to Great Britain, to Sweden, to France, or whatever, when these are signatory countries that are just ostensibly saying it will only apply to international trade? Well, the way it does is that there's so many interlocking treaties that have been signed, and agreements, executive agreements and legislative agreements and the like, even handshake-type agreements that have been signed amongst the various countries. There's the sanitary and phytosanitary agreement. There's technical barriers to trade agreement. For North America, there's the North America Free Trade Agreement. For the European Union, there's just the European Union itself. There's the Central American Free Trade Agreement. You name it. There are just a bundle of these things out there that are interlocking, like fingers interlacing amongst each other, that just tie us in both domestically and internationally towards implementation of this. In fact, even in the Codex Alimentarius Commission strategic plan that they most recently put out, they mentioned no fewer than five or six times within it that these standards and guidelines are to be implemented internationally and domestically. So what they're trying to do is get international standards that are created by these unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats who don't represent you or me, and I'll explain that more in a minute. And then they will be implemented domestically to suppress health freedom within those signatory countries.
So there's no kind of referendum or voting going on here?
No, it's not even like the European Union Treaty, the Treaty of Nice or Lisbon.
Yeah.
Nothing like that. It's all being done. And you would actually, and this was, I appreciate your having asked this before, you wanted me to kind of paint a picture of these meetings.
Yes.
Maybe now is the right time to do that.
Absolutely.
You go to these meetings, and each committee is, as I mentioned, is hosted by a particular country. And let's take Germany, because it's the one we're most interested in at NHF. You go to the German meeting, and it lasts for a week. It's announced well in advance, so you can make travel plans and arrangements and the like well in advance. You go to the meeting. It typically starts on a Monday, but there are working groups that meet informally or formally beforehand, and these are like subcommittees, but they're called working groups. They're either electronic working groups, EWGs, or they're physical working groups, PWGs, and that meet face-to-face. In most cases, they're both. And these usually meet on the Saturday preceding and Sunday preceding the start of the meeting on Monday. And we typically try to go to those because increasingly the power is devolving down to the working groups. In the same way that the commission just rubber stamps what the committee does, now you find frequently the committee's just rubber stamping what the electronic or the physical working groups are doing without much further discussion. And so it's very important to go to these working group meetings now. So we typically go to those, and then the meeting itself will start, the committee meeting will start on a Monday, and will go through a Friday to the end where they have a report that is read and approved by a report of the meeting results that's read and approved by the members. Now, there are basically three types of people that attend these meetings, not including the actual Codex staff, which, by the way, I have to compliment. They're very efficient. They know what they're doing. They've been at this for years, and they're, for the most part, from what I've seen and the way they've treated us, they're very impartial. I can only commend them.
Is this also an international group, so to speak, or is this also people from many different countries, or to represent kind of international?
Well, typically, it's the FAO people. With some WHO people thrown in. FAO pays most of the bills, so they provide most of the people. Okay. And the FAO staff is quite competent. They know what they're doing. They've been doing this for years, and they've been very, very fair to us for the most part. There were a couple instances some years ago, but I haven't seen any fine in that sense. And then the host country will provide the actual chairman or chairwoman, and that person, man or woman, can or may not be fair depending on the country. We found, for instance, Dr. Ann McKenzie, the chairwoman for the Codex Committee of Food Labeling, a Canadian, at the Ottawa meetings, to be quite fair and actually quite inclined our way. In contrast, there's Dr. Rolf Grossklaus, who has berated us on the floor, and I've gotten into heated discussions with him on the floor and did not feel very fairly treated by him, and he's very anti-health freedom at the German meetings. So you get kind of both ranges. And in any event, so you go to these meetings, and alphabetically seated at the top, at the front is a podium. Just picture a podium in a big hall. And then there's some space between that. There are lots of screens, computer screens, for the people at the podium to look at. And then to see what's going on, like who has the camera trained on them and who will be speaking next, because there will be a list when you punch your button to speak. It shows up on these computer screens in order, and they will take the countries first, and the countries are arrayed behind tables in front of the podium alphabetically from Albania and Afghanistan to Zimbabwe.
Right.
Sweden's in there, United States is in there, the Great Britain is in there, but mostly the European countries do not speak out except through the EC representative, the European Commission representative. Only rarely will the countries speak out. Usually that's the United Kingdom, France, sometimes Germany, and rarely any others. Now, Norway will speak out, of course, not being a member of the EU.
Right.
Norway will speak out independently, but you'll almost never hear a word out of Sweden. You'll almost never hear a word out of Ireland, the Netherlands, or any of that, unless they have the presidency of the European Union, in which case they might provide the person who is the EC representative. So you have these countries first, and they get priority in speaking. And then behind them are the INGOs, the International Non-Governmental Organizations,
yes,
also arrayed or arranged alphabetically. And the National Health Federation usually is near the back of that, just because of our alphabetic listing of our names, since most of these organizations start with their names start with association or international. Most of them come in front of us, but it doesn't matter because we often have a really good seat anyway, unless they try to sabotage us somehow and seat us behind a pillar, like the Germans did 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. Yeah, they actually had it where I was looking at a mirrored pillar I'd just seen myself. Fortunately, I caught this during a working group meeting, so I was able to make them force them actually to make a change before the Monday meeting opened. And we were not even arranged alphabetically. They had deliberately done it. It was so obvious because we're probably the most vocal INGO at these meetings on the issues that concern us. Typically at a meeting, I will speak out at the meeting on whatever topic we're interested in more than all the other INGOs combined.
Really?
That is not unusual. And often I will speak out in such a way that is very atypical as well. I've had people come up to us and say, "You're a funny group. You talk differently than the others." And I usually say, "Oh, well, that's because we don't say the usual bureaucratic bullshit."
There you go.
Other people say. So although I usually say it more politely than that, but the fact of the matter is we then get a chance to speak too. Usually you push a button by the microphone or on the microphone that is in front of you, and then it doesn't make a sound or anything, but it throws up your name at the computer screen, and then the chairman will eventually recognize you after the countries have all spoken. There have been times where the German chairman refused to recognize us to speak, and I had to confront him about it, and then he started recognizing us again. And
is that common?
Third group of Pardon?
Is that common across the board, the way that you're treated, that you're looked upon as the black sheep, I guess, in this group? Is that right?
We are the black sheep, but it's typically just at the German committee, not at the Canadian one, not at the French one. In fact, our comments were very welcome at the French one and the Canadian one, and even the Chinese one. We found at the last Beijing meeting, Codex Committee on Food Additives, that we agreed with the chairman. Chairman agreed with us, and we were virtually alone. For example, on aluminum food contaminants, the people there wanted aluminum as a food additive, and both the chairman and we, that is the NHF, viewed aluminum in food as a contaminant.
Yeah.
And the chairman agreed with us and said, yes. In fact, in past years, it was considered to be a contaminant. Here we are looking to still include it as a food additive. It was amazing. Because we were there to fight aspartame and sucralose and those kind of food additives that are being approved under Codex standards and which we find to be quite dangerous.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And it was amazing. We were the only voice to speak out against that at the meeting. And then on the aluminum containing food, you know, they typically will add aluminum to like baking products, those sort of things. So they wanted certain trade industries and countries wanted that in. And like I said, the chairman and NHF were the only ones to speak out against that.
Hmm. Really interesting. And would you say that generally people are they informed, or if we're talking about the other those who are representative of the nations and so forth, and some of the other NGOs, or are they just generally more quiet and just help the process along and, as you say, rubber stamp and approve stuff? Or do they even try to ask, you know, is this really good? Is there a debate going on in that sense, like where you might come with some kind of information that demonstrates why this should not be implemented? Is that how it works?
Well, those are all excellent questions, Henrik. Basically, the one thing I need to emphasize are the countries are represented by their bureaucrats, food bureaucrats, basically. So, for example, in the United States, we are not elected by someone who has our viewpoint. We're represented, Americans are represented by a Food and Drug Administration bureaucrat who has widely disparate, separate views from us.
Yeah.
On a whole range of issues. They have they have control viewpoints, not freedom viewpoints. So
that's right.
They want to think about passing more rules and regulations and controlling our activities more as opposed to what, say, you or I might be interested in, that is the freedom to choose.
Yes.
So they find it quite natural to create this web of rules and regulations and standards and guidelines that be thousands of pages long when it's all done and said, and think nothing of it. Whereas I, on the other hand, have a far more, shall we say, libertarian viewpoint that people should be free to decide and to choose.
Yes. I mean,
it's like David Friedman said once, people should have the right to go to hell in their own way. And this includes the right to make mistakes.
Absolutely.
And these kind of bureaucrats want to control us to such an extent that we can't even make the right decisions, let alone the wrong decisions. And in doing so, they risk, and this is the big risk for all of this, that you make one big, great mistake by these bureaucrats that will cost many countless thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of lives, because it's all been so centralized and so concentrated in one thing that all it takes is one mistake there, and as opposed to a localized mistake that we can learn from and recover from.
Yes.
So these bureaucrats have no interest in freedom, but occasionally you find some who do.
Okay.
Occasionally and rarely. The South African delegate in years past, she's since been silenced. Antoinette Boysen was quite good. She would speak up for health freedom, and she was our only ally when we were fighting to thwart and keep from being passed the dietary supplement guidelines that will restrict our freedom to buy the kind of supplements that we would like to have. She was our only ally, and that has since been taken from us. So we're developing other allies, and we think we have some, but I won't necessarily go into that now because who knows, they might be silenced before they can be of use as well in this fight for health freedom. So you have these bureaucrats who are there. The third group that I didn't get to is just general public and press.
Okay.
They can go. They can't talk or contribute to the meetings. They sit up in the nosebleed section of the gallery, so to speak, and they just observe. And those are the three basic groups, not including the staff members at the podium.
Right. Okay. Well, it's very interesting to hear how it goes on, as it were, behind the scenes. Is there scientific debates then going on? I mean, for example, if you are pressing on certain issues where they're trying to implement the aluminum as an additive, as you mentioned before, do you present your case, so to speak, then for why this should not be implemented, and do other people try to refute that in, you know, or how does it work?
Yes. No, we do, Henrik, we do present our case both privately, one-on-one to various members, and then in written documents that we can submit for publication and distribution by the Codex committees to the various members that are attending there. Now, there's one other thing I left out. How do they reach, and I should have told you this earlier, how do they reach decisions? Here you have the chairman or the chairwoman up there, and then how did they decide to move on? Do they take a vote? What do they do?
Yeah.
Most people think they take a vote. They don't. I've only seen them take votes on a few rare occasions at the commission level only, and that was in close question. Usually what happens is the chairman or chairwoman lifts his or her head up and says, do we have consensus? That's their magic word.
Really?
Consensus. Do we have consensus here? And no one seems to know what consensus really means. There's actually a definition in the Codex rule book, so to speak, that says consensus is the absence of sustained opposition.
Okay.
But if you ask the chairman of the German committee, he'll say, no, it doesn't mean that. It just means whenever I say there's consensus, there's consensus. So basically the chairman will look up and around, say, well, is this the consensus? And if there's no one who speaks up, and he goes, or even if there is, he says, yeah, there's consensus, let's adopt this and move on. Now, occasionally you have someone who will speak up steadily, like the South African, and instead of taking that as sustained opposition, which would mean, under the Codex rule book, that it should not move forward, the chairman quite cleverly will say, oh, we will note your objection in the report. And that's supposed to satisfy that country. They did that to China in 2005 with the adoption of the dietary supplement, food supplements guideline. And they've done it to South Africa. I've seen them do it numerous times. It's a clever little trick that the chairman and chairwoman will use. But technically, if the country knows what it's doing and knows its rights, it should say, no, I don't want it noted in the report.
All right.
Taking sustained opposition to this, and it should not move forward till we are satisfied. But the Chinese are a little bit confounded because they don't speak English as a first language, so they get steamrolled a bit easily. And the others are usually too cowed by the chairman or chairwoman to do anything else but say meekly, yes, okay, thank you, Your Honor.
When the chairman or the chairwoman asks for this consensus, can you or your group speak out at that point, or are you do not have the permission to debate further after that? Or
well, we do and often do speak out, and I have even said just to the committee just what I've said to you and to your listeners now. The problem is usually by that stage of the game, the chairman is not entertaining any more discussion from the floor. So I have many a time pushed the button on the microphone to be recognized, and I just don't get called upon. So then I cannot speak out, despite making efforts to do so. The other thing to note is that, you know, there might be 200 to 300 delegates at each of these meetings. I mean, all people included, including the main delegate and then the assistant delegate and then members of the delegation for a particular country. But probably only 5 to 10% of these delegates will speak out, if even that many. And at these meetings, what that means is, if you don't speak out, it's almost the same as if you aren't there. If you don't submit papers to be read and reviewed and then comment upon them, it's almost the same as if you aren't even at the meeting. So essentially, the meetings are corralled by certain pressure groups, and that's it, certain countries. The EC is a driving force that's quite powerful there. The United States somewhat also, but not as much as the European Commission. Canada somewhat. The UK not so much because it's subsumed within the European Union delegation and our European Commission delegation. So really, what the, and I commented on this once before at the German committee level about 5 years ago, what the EC wants, the EC gets. Really? I've even seen the EC delegate giving instructions to the German chairman brazenly there on the floor in front of everyone.
Really?
You do this.
Really?
And, incredible. Oh, yeah. The, and so what the EC is trying to do is to get the Codex guidelines to mirror, to match, actually, the EC guidelines on food supplements.
Would you
want them to be the same?
Would you say that the EC, the European Commission, is the driving force behind this? Or I can elaborate further on that question and ask, are propositions submitted to the Codex Committee on what should, for example, be implemented, a supplement or something like that?
Well, that's a question that requires an involved answer, but the EC has its agenda, and it's changed a little bit over the years through the influence of the U.S. and Canada, perhaps, but not by much. Primarily, it's the EC agenda that's moving forward in this particular committee, and I've had knockdown, drag out verbal arguments with the EC representative Basil Mathewdakis on the Codex Committee floors to where, I mean, he just hated my guts, and I didn't feel too kindly towards him either. But basically, what they're trying to do is to match the EC guidelines, and they are able to do this through almost word for word to match what's going on with the EC.
Yeah.
But let me think about this a little bit more with your question, because really the problem is that sometimes the Codex agenda cannot advance very far because the EC itself hasn't made up its mind yet what its own rules will do.
Okay.
So sometimes that stymies, fortunately, the advance of the Codex guidelines and their implementation, ultimate implementation. But I don't know if I really answered your question. Maybe you, there's a part there that I missed, and if you want to restate it.
Right. Well, it has to do with how things are suggested, or, you know, if propositions are submitted to the Codex Committee.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, of course. Well, because it's been going on for such a long time, it's really done piecemeal. The EC or the U.S. or Canada or any of the other countries will submit paperwork that will be considered by the committee and for changes that go in to, for example, the guidelines. But see, they have a process called the eight-step process, and most of the guidelines are either approved for whatever issue it may be, or they're so far along in the process that you can only change a few words here and there. So it's almost too late to do anything with a number of these guidelines.
Okay.
For example, the food supplements guideline, let's take it as an example. It's already, the framework has already been approved both at the committee level and the commission level, but it is just a framework. For example, they say, there will be maximum upper limits on vitamins and minerals, and there will be minimum limits on vitamins and minerals, both of which, by the way, the NHF argued strenuously against. It's ridiculous to have minimum levels. There are special formulations that might require just a small amount of limits, that is, which are 15% of recommended dietary intake, would prevent that. So you're effectively cutting out certain formulations. But these idiots at Codex don't seem to realize that. They just don't want people getting too little of a particular nutrient. But on the other hand, they want to set a ceiling as well, and they don't want you to get too much, which in their view is a ridiculously low level of nutrition that is just barely enough. And so the proposals that get submitted are really kind of piecemeal type proposals. But in the food supplements guideline, they need to fill in the blanks. They don't have the upper limit set yet, which in turn means they don't have the lower limit set yet. And so we're now going through the process of using risk-based assessment techniques and analysis to establish what those are, with the NHF, of course, arguing they should be as high as possible. And then you have certain countries like Denmark and Norway that want them set at basically just the RDI level. And then you have some other countries in between that want something a little bit better than that, but not too much because it might be scary. So, you know, all these bureaucrats, they're basically a bunch of scaredy cats, or at least they turn out to be that way, because they, you know, they get punished if something happens to a person, you know, if they get killed or injured by a high potency vitamin, which of course we know is very rare, and in fact they're more likely to be harmed and injured by a pharmaceutical drug or a lightning strike or a bee sting dietary supplement.
Right.
The statistics are really clear on that. And so it's in their interest to make things as quote safe, close quote, as possible, because then no blame will go to them. It doesn't matter that 800,000 people died because of a nutritional deficiency that led to heart attacks or cancer or the like. That can't be blamed on them because it's not directly traceable to them. But if they let out a drug or a supplement that does harm someone directly, then they can be blamed for that. So for the sake of saving perhaps one or two lives a year, they don't mind killing 80,000, actually a million people a year, through their application of a toxicological model to vitamins and minerals, to natural products that should only be applied to human-made artificial products. But that's what they're doing.
It's incredible. And this goes under the guise of standardization. I understand that this is about international standardization of what food is supposed to be. But what do you ultimately see is the purpose here? I see that this obviously is limiting people's health freedom, as you mentioned before. Would you say that there's some other agenda here as well, or how far do you go in regards to what the purpose is?
Another excellent question on your part, Henry. I would say there's definitely an agenda here, and you know, companies that operate in the free market that are facing competition, they have really two basic ways to deal with it, other than the third one, which is to go out of business. The two basic ways are to increase their own efficiency and compete fairly in the marketplace with these competitors. The other way is to do the age-old fashioned European and now American fashion of running to the government for protection. Whether it's the gas lamp lighters with the advent of electricity, whether it's certain other companies. I mean, there's a whole list of types of companies facing obsolescence or becoming obsolete that run to the government for protection and use the government's coercive police powers to eliminate or suppress the competition. And that's what we see going on here. You have pharmaceutical companies, arguably the most profitable business on the planet, facing increasing competition from natural health care products that are cheaper, more effective, and without side effects. You have all the benefits and very few of the risks, and they see this. So what do? They run to the government of Sweden. They run to the government of the UK. They run to the European Commission in Brussels. They run to the Washington, D.C. and the United States, to Ottawa and Canada, to Canberra in Australia, you name it, they run there and they seek laws and regulations ostensibly to protect consumers. It's always about protecting consumers. These dangerous vitamins and minerals, these dangerous organic supplements, they need to be regulated because without us regulating them, how can you be protected? That's the usual cry. And, you know, for most people, it resonates. Oh, yeah, if they're so safe, of course they could be regulated.
Right, yeah, exactly.
But what most people don't realize is who's going to regulate it. Who's going to control the FDA in the U.S.?
Mm.
Is it going to be the vitamin companies or the pharmaceutical companies? Of course it's going to be the pharmaceutical companies. You know, this whole concept of consumer agencies protecting our interests is one of the biggest myths of the 20th and 21st century. They're never protecting consumer interests, never. There's not one. Mm. They protect the industry's interests they were meant to regulate in the first place, whether it's the trucking companies, whether it's the television industry, whether it's the airline industry, and whether it's the pharmaceutical drug industry. Who has the most interest in these agencies? Is it you or I? I mean, drugs occupy maybe 1% of our interest during the day. No, we're interested in books. We're interested in going to work. We have our personal lives, all of that. But
for
drug companies, it's 100% of their life.
Of course.
They're directly affected. The bottom line is affected. So, of course, that's why they spend $6 million a day on lobbyists in the United States, the federal lobbying alone. They're going to be right there and make sure their interests are protected. And this whole concept of captured agencies comes about. These agencies get captured by the industries they are meant to regulate.
Who's
going to be enforcing these rules? It's going to be the pharmaceutical companies, not us. And so they are going to use it to eliminate the competition. And what better way to do it now than through codex, through distant, unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats who are making these rules and regulations far from the shores of the United States, far from the shores of Great Britain, even from the shores of Sweden.
Yes.
And they can do this in near silence. Only outfits like the National Health Federation and a few others have drawn attention to it. And it's a real huge danger.
Yeah. Just quickly here, Scott, has there been any kind of scandals with some of the people who are involved in this in regards to bribes or whatnot, potential connections between drug companies and the people who are sitting on the committee or something like that?
I wish we had the resources to uncover that. Undoubtedly, there's something going on, but there's nothing that we could prove or we could show. But there undoubtedly is something going on, and it's just has not surfaced yet. Someday it will surface, I'm sure. But I can't say that such has happened just yet. It's just the nature of the beast, though. And a lot of times it doesn't take the form of an exchange of money in hands directly, but it's this revolving door thing.
Yes.
Some of these bureaucrats end up getting jobs at the drug companies after they retire.
Yeah.
So they can double dip with their income. And you see that in the United States a lot. And that's where I'm most familiar with it. But yeah, it's just the nature of the beast to have it happen. It's just that we haven't. They've been very careful about showing it.
Yeah.
But the results are there. And even some of these trade industries for vitamin and mineral supplements, they have been taken over by pharmaceutical companies that bought up some of the major supplement companies. So now you see supplement companies supporting these rules and regulations also.
Mm-hmm. I do want to spend a little bit of time in just a little while talking a little bit more about the National Health Federation and the implementation of the UK and French branch of that. But before we just go to that and begin to round things up here, if you look ahead a little bit in time here, and I know that, again, as you pointed out before, that Codex is a process, meaning that this will take a long time to get implemented. And by that time, by, let's say, 2013, new questions and things have undoubtedly popped up on their agenda, so to speak, of what they're trying to do and change and refine their own laws and so forth. But if you look at what they are trying to do right now and then look ahead into the future and see if all of this that they want to have implemented, if that indeed becomes implemented, what do you see that the consequences of this will be? How, you know, if you can talk a little bit about how that might affect us on a day-to-day level or basis.
Well, it would be an incredibly reduced state of health. Low, you know, less nourishing food. It's already been shown that over the last 50 years, the quality of the food that we've been eating, unless you've been eating organic, has declined considerably. Most Britons eating food in Great Britain, they get very little selenium out of their diet. Selenium's very important as an anti-aging mineral and also as an antiviral agent. Men who have adequate levels of selenium, that is about 200 micrograms a day, have half the chance of catching the HIV virus as those who do not, just as an example. So it's super important for supplements to be there for people who have inadequate diets, low-cost supplements. It's also very important for people to be able to eat organic or non-GM foods.
Yeah.
It's very important for people not to be forced into compulsory immunization and the like. And so as time goes on, people get more and more regulated and accepting of these kind of demands made of them upon them by their own governments, and they'll get used to eating the me too junk food kind of diet, and the lifespans and the health of the people during those lifespans will suffer considerably. There will be more deaths, shorter lives, and more ill health during those shorter lifespans as well.
It's really
incredible.
Yeah.
And what is going on here. But what does that mean? I mean, why would that interest pharmaceutical companies? Hey, suddenly they have more customers.
Exactly. Yeah.
Don't go take vitamin D as an anti-cancer agent. You go take one of their chemotherapeutic drugs instead, or you go and have surgery or radiation treatment instead, when simply taking adequate levels of natural vitamin D could help prevent that cancer in the first place. And anyone living in northern latitude needs it, especially darker skinned peoples who have very efficient skin that blocks out the vitamin D production in the skin. And you just need to take vitamin D as a supplement to avoid cancer, viruses, bacteria, and the like.
Yeah.
It's very, very important, just one of many things that are important to consume.
Okay, so obviously go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. And then you had asked about the NHF in the UK. One of the things we did, and starting next week on the 17th, St. Patrick's Day, we're launching officially the National Health Federation in the United Kingdom. We've had members in the UK for decades. It's just that now we're going to make it official with an actual organization based in Cardiff, Wales, for all of the UK. And then I was just on the phone today with a group of people who will be starting the NHF France as well. We don't have a date set for that yet. I'll have to meet with them, and there will be some further discussions. But we're making a concentrated effort to get the message out to consumers and to act in a concerted way on local, regional, and national issues that are important to Britons in that case and French in the latter case. And then we also have the strong likelihood that a similar organization will spring up in South Africa as well. So we are expanding and definitely not contracting. And this is very encouraging because more and more people are waking up and more people see the need to do what we're saying they need to do. That
yes.
is that these politicians, they don't see the light. They just feel the heat. So we have to light a fire under them. I mean, and you have to do it persistently. You don't just contact them once. You keep riding their case, and you make sure that they do what you want to do
yes.
and have done to preserve your freedom. And that's what it's all about, Henry.
Very, very important. And we know, again, as more and more comes to light of what actually is really going on here, we definitely understand how important this issue is to our own health, obviously. I want to talk a little bit about what people can do to also support you. You mentioned previously here that you have a Health Federation news magazine. Is that something that people can subscribe to through your website that helps to fund you guys and keep you going and to help to keep you expanding? Is that how it works?
Yes. Thanks for asking. There are several ways. One, you just go to our website, which you mentioned before, www.thenhf.com, and you can sign up for free on the e-list. And we're very strict about not giving away or selling or trading or exchanging or divulging in any way our e-list. That is kept strictly with us. In fact, there are only three people in the NHF who even have access to that e-list, let alone anyone else. We even fought a court case in the early 90s not to give out our private membership information. Mm-hmm. So it's kept very, very confidential, and we don't send it out. You won't get spammed with it. And so I encourage all your listeners to sign up there for our e-blasts and other announcements and information. The second thing to do, and maybe more importantly even, is not just to sign up for that, but to join as a member. If you're in the United States, it's only $36 a year, and you get the magazine. You don't subscribe to the magazine separately. If you're outside the United States, it's $81 a year because of the cost of sending the magazine, but we're considering having it work differently, where you can sign up without getting the magazine, or you get it online as a PDF file, in which case the cost would probably be about half that. Mm. And then the other way is to contact us if you're interested. If you're a listener in the United Kingdom, contact us and we'll put you in touch with a local representative there in Wales who is sort of the linchpin for launching this in the UK. The same thing with France. We can put you in touch there. And also, if any of your listeners are interested in starting NHF in another country,
yes,
whether it's Germany,
exactly,
or Spain or whatnot, mm, please contact us that way as well,
and for that reason as well. And through the website is the best way. You have emails and contact forms there?
Yes, there's a button that says contact us, and it can be done through that. Or if someone wants to contact me directly, it's my initials, SCT@thenhf.com. So SCT, Scott C. Tips. SCT@thenhf.com, and I'll get that directly as well.
Excellent. Again, I want to mention the website, thenhf.com. And to round things up here, Scott, for this time, and again, I want to thank you for your time, of course, but just mention a little bit about what you will be addressing during the AV2 conference here at the end of May in London.
Well, it will be a lot. I hate to say it, but it'll be a lot of what I've said in this 1 hour that we've had together, but it'll be expanding on it a lot more details.
What
people can do,
yes,
about the wider spread dangers. I mean, this has given sort of the basics, but
yeah,
it will be much more comprehensive and much more direct. And then, of course, the audience will have the ability to, you know, pose their particular questions of me. And the other speakers as well. So I would highly recommend that people attend that event because it'll be much more interactive and even more comprehensive.
Absolutely. And again, people can ask you questions and hear a little bit more about what it would be to set up a local branch in the country that you are in, and
right,
so forth. So that's very good. Again, for people who are interested, avii.co.uk is the website for the Alternative View 2 conference at the end of May in London. Head on over there, check it out if you're interested in attending. And to round things up here for this time, Scott, I want to thank you very much for your time. I know that you're doing excellent work, and do keep it up because it's very important, and I hope to see that this is just continue to expanding, and the people help to support you either by going to the website and subscribing, or trying to get the magazine or do something in order to keep you guys going. Definitely.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I appreciate all your efforts, and of course those of you in Crane who have been instrumental in arranging this interview with you, and he deserves special thanks for that.
Absolutely.
All his other efforts. But I do appreciate the time, and like I said before, I'm honored to be on your program. And if you ever want me on again, please just ask, and I'll be happy to do that.
Absolutely. We definitely want to keep up with this issue because I think it's It's so important. So we definitely want to stay in contact with you, Scott, and have you back on. But again, it's going to be great as well to of course, see you speak over at London. So we're looking forward to seeing you there.
And same here. I look forward to seeing you. Thanks so much, Henry.
Thank you.